Hello, I'm Alison Larkin, writer, comedian, narrator, and host of the Jane Austen podcast. Join me as we embark on a journey through Austen's timeless stories, starting with Pride and Prejudice. The Jane Austen podcast with Alison Larkin is available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to Angel on Top. Just a few announcements before we get into Reprise. Reprise?
For our $10 patrons and up, we've curated a video of our 10 favorite things that are getting Brittany and Laura through quarantine. Look for that video posted this week exclusively on our Patreon, along with links so you can indulge in our favorite things with us. If you want to support our Patreon or up your patronage, you can go to patreon.com/angelontopcast.
Congratulations to our beloved J. August Richards, a.k.a. Gunn. He came out publicly for the first time this week. He was giving an interview about a new show that he's on in which he plays a gay dad. And he said, quote, "I knew that I could not portray this gay man honestly without letting you all know that I was a gay man myself. I've never done that with the people I've worked with. I knew how important it is to other people out there like me who would need to see that role model." So congratulations.
I love that, sweetie.
What a lovely light spot in these strange times.
And another was that at 420 yesterday on 420, we're recording this on 421, Marty Noxon tweeted, "Blaze it."
Okay, Marty. We see Wonder you. What she's rewatching right now. We also wanted to give a trigger warning for this episode. If you have trauma triggered by a conversation about suicide, specifically suicide attempt, we want you to have that knowledge so you can make the best decision for yourself about whether to keep listening. The subject matter will come up toward the end of the episode. Welcome back to Angel on Top, a podcast where we watch and discuss every episode of Angel one by one, spoiler-free, and in tandem with Buffering the Vampire Slayer. I'm Laura Zach.
And I'm Brittany Ashley. And this week we're watching Reprise. Stick around until the end for an original poem written by us through the perspective of Angle.
Reprise was written by Tim Minear and directed by James Whitmore Jr. It aired on February 20th, 2001.
This is the one. We're on the eve of a 75-year review at Wolfram & Hart. Angel seeks a magic ring that will take him to hell to look for the firm's senior partners.
It's also the one where Angel and Darla do it.
Hell yeah.
Welcome back, everyone. Hope you are doing okay. I know it's been a weird cyclical ride for me where I'm either completely okay or the worst. So I hope you're all hanging in there and being gentle with yourselves and patient with yourselves and each other. And yeah, thank you for listening. It's interesting how my relationship to the podcast feels like it's evolving. Like, this is such a point of ritual and normalcy now that I'm just more grateful than ever to have this community. So
yeah, completely. It's like nice to also put something out into the world that people are depending on for their own mental health or for their own, you know, routine of normalcy. So I'm happy and privileged to provide that and that I get to talk to you about this great show.
Yeah, and what a wild episode.
Oh, man. Yeah, this episode rules, and I'm sure you've noticed that it is the reprise to Surprise, the Buffy episode in season 2 when Angel turns into Angelus, and there's a shitload of links between this episode of Angel and that episode of Buffy.
I definitely noticed a lot of parallels to Buffy, but I did not know it was that much of a one-to-one comparison. So I hope that you have come loaded with lots of relevant fun facts in that regard.
I'm loaded, bloated, and something else that rhymes with oated.
So we start with Angel in an unfortunate looking hallway. I'm pretty sure I saw a creepy doll in a shopping cart.
Yeah.
That was part of the set design. So yeah, you know that when you start there, you need to buckle up.
It made me think that it was like abandoned orphanage, maybe.
But instead of children, this seems to be a home for goats.
Yeah.
There's just a room full of goats, and Angel walks in on two guys practicing their speak for some sort of sacrifice that they're going to do, which we're meant to understand that they're planning on sacrificing one of these goats.
Fun fact, which is that one of the actors sacrificing the goats is writer-producer David Fury, who also has a larger acting role in a fifth season episode, Smile Time.
Do you think he actually acts as well, or it was one of those like, oh, we need someone to fill this role last minute things?
I definitely don't think that either of those actors were like incredible. You know what I mean? Like, they definitely had a vibe of like they were dusting off their acting chops to do this scene. But I mean, you know, they got the job done. But I think that's also pretty common to like throw in people who work on the show because they think it'll be like a fun thing, and there's just little Easter eggs of being able to throw them in somewhere.
And you know what? They were right, because 19 years or 20 years later, almost 20 years later, we are still appreciating them.
We sure are.
And it becomes clear that Angel's investment in these goat sacrificers is that he knows that Wolfram and Hart has put them up to this. And he's trying to figure out who they're praying to. And they're just like, I don't know, man. We just get paid to say the prayers. And we got to do it by midnight, or someone out there is going to be real pissed off. And then Angel says, good, and takes them out.
It kind of reminded me of like the hackers, or like the people who were paid to be trolls against Hillary in the 2016 election, like the internet trolls, who, when they were interviewed, they were like, people were like, do you know what you were saying? Like, it was horrible. And they're like, I just got paid to say this script. Like, I didn't know I like ended democracy or anything. I was just doing my job. So it's like this job where they can kind of like rest their laurels on like, I'm just doing a job. I don't really believe in this type of stuff. Like, they didn't really strike me as guys who like get off on goat sacrificing, or it's something that they want to do. It seems like they were just kind of like a Craigslist gig.
It's not their passion.
No, not at all. Like, dance is my passion. It wasn't their passion.
After the opening credits, we get a reminder of the girl with the eye in the back of her head, the storyline that got sort of left in the dust last episode. And it turns out we never really get to see how it's resolved. We just find out that it was resolved, and that Gunn, Wesley, and Cordelia are pretty pleased with themselves. They found some charm that worked. And the mom, who is, if you'll recall, a client that Virginia brought in, pushes back on paying them.
Yeah.
And basically evokes her husband and is like, Steve said that since it's impossible to have an eye grow in the back of your head, you're all running a scam. So like, the denial is so deep that once the child is healed, they are in a place of like, if we pay you, that means we have to acknowledge that all of this is real life, and that is too terrifying, and also we're selfish and stingy.
Yeah. Also in this scene, Cordelia has major My Stepmom hair energy, and Wesley gives a teenager a lollipop that he just, I don't know, had in his shorts pocket.
I feel like there was something about this mom's position that felt a little bit like the COVID protesters. Or like,
yeah,
you know, not that they deny that, not that all of them deny that COVID is real, but just sort of like very me-centered, and not, and sort of like, I'm unwilling to acknowledge that this is a larger problem.
Yeah. And I mean, and also like screwing over people and the services they provide just for your own benefit, and believing that people just live to serve you.
Mm-mm. And Gunn, you can tell, has had it. Our dear sweet J. August Richards. He seems to, you know, think at this point that he's going to see more action and be able to do more good just going back to the streets and seeing what's going on there. So again, it's implied that Angel Investigations, or what's left of it, is stalling out a little bit.
Yeah, they can't really figure out how to get business. And then once they do get business, like how they force people to pay them, which is obviously a major problem. But then speaking of keeping a job, Lila at Wolfram and Hart is very afraid of losing her job as this 75-year review is coming up. And Lindsay is definitely very casual about it. He's still in this phase of just kind of thinking that he's invincible because, you know, Darla kissed him on the cheek once or something. But Lila asks if Lindsay's seen Darla or Drusilla, and he's like, no, of course I haven't. They got like burned in a fire. I'm not gonna see them. They need to go retreat.
And then they make a reference to some big review that's coming up on Friday. And Friday is also the day that the guys with the goats was talking about. So there's clearly some connection between these two stories. But Lila and Lindsay sort of are always, ever since the massacre in the wine cellar, they've always been worried about their asses. So it's hard to tell at first, like, is this just run of the mill paranoia or is this something special?
Yeah, you survive a massacre once and people start questioning you. It's classic.
And because Angel is mopey and has isolated himself to a degree that he has no one else to talk to, Kate is the one that he now goes when he needs to talk to someone. And I feel like the last time we saw Kate, we commented on how like, oh, it's strange that she's not furious with him, given that she gave him one more chance and then a bunch of people got killed because he did not stop Drusilla and Darla from killing people. And this is actually the moment where it seems like some intel has come in since the last time we saw her, where she understands now that there wasn't a break-in and the victims were actually locked in the wine cellar from the outside. And she's essentially like, I'm done helping you now. So now she understands that she had basically aided Angel in aiding Drew and Darla.
Yeah. And it's not only her that knows that, like, because of the last episode where Angel beat the shit out of that captain, Kate kind of got implicated in that, and we've seen her be like the pariah of her police station because she, quote unquote, believes that there are creatures and evil things out in the night that go beyond the human form. When she says they've been looking for an excuse, it's kind of like this is the last straw. Something that Angel had done is kind of like the last straw, and she's afraid that she's gonna lose her job.
She's fully become the Dana Scully now. She's the one who believes in weirdo stuff and the paranormal, and there's also clearly a lot of corruption within the police force. And so the people who are actually the most evil and who do know that these dark forces exist don't want her talking because they're benefiting from these dark forces. Like, they are counting on the paranormal being a thing in order to enact how they want to run the police force. So
yeah,
she also, there's this theme of like reviews and major kind of like career check-ins here. So Kate also is facing that. And I know I'm obsessed with The Class right now. Which is this this exercise class that I've been doing the like 2-week free trial, and I've gotten really into it. But the head woman is Taryn Toomey. And does Kate not give you pretty intense Taryn vibes?
Their voices kind of, yeah. And like,
I guess most
general affects. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I was just like, when is Kate going to be like, you know, talking about giving up the old stories that you need to let go of and to clean your heart space.
Yeah. I mean, I think after she like fully grieves, I mean, not, you never fully grieve, but I think after she grieves her father's death, I could see Kate going the route of like marrying some hedge fund guy and then opening up her therapy dance practice.
Oh, I hope that for her. I hope that after what transpires in this episode, she gets to turn over a new leaf.
Yeah.
Lindsay, after telling Lila that he has no idea where Darla and Drusilla are, you know, of course we suspected that because he's obsessed with Darla, mm-hmm. but he comes home and Darla is there. And
wait, should we play the Darla jingle? To Darla. All right, cool.
Oh, wait. Do we have that somewhere?
Yeah, it was just right there. I did it live.
Oh, why don't you do it one more time better?
To Darla.
You know what? We love Jenny Owen Youngs and her musical talent, but sometimes you just have to go
with acapella.
To Darla. I got so excited. I was like, wait, we have a Darla jingle?
Oh, a cover. I liked your cover version of mine. Baby girl's got some burns.
She also is very good at using him. Like, the way she's talking to him is in order to make him believe that she actually is into him now, because she's dependent upon him. Like, you saved me, you know? Like,
mm-hmm. But I think I feel like that is the dynamic that Lindsay prefers. I think he wants to believe as though he has saved someone. Because I don't think he's ever really accepted the fact that Darla is much stronger than him and doesn't totally need him in the way that he thinks. Like, I think that Lindsay's pretty replaceable in this instance. And so I think that he is hoping that the dynamic will be that, you know, he comes home from work, she's waiting for him, and he's saving her. He's her savior.
I think there's something about Darla that represents the conflict within Lindsay as well, because, you know, we've seen in his journey he hit some ethical roadblocks, and we definitely saw that there was one moment where he almost left Wilfram and Hart entirely. And we've seen that in the past he's had lines that he wouldn't cross around, like who he was willing to help kill and in terms of children or something like that. And there's just something about Darla, especially obviously when she was human, that was so needy and or appeared so needy and mm-hmm. appeared like someone that he could save. And so it's like he kind of gets to, or maybe he thinks he gets to have both in pursuing her,
right?
Because she's both powerful and needs him.
I really liked the part where he goes to take a shower and she's like, you always take a shower, but you're never dirty. And he looks off into the distance and he says, I'm always dirty. And then he walks away and I bet he's like, damn, dude, that fucking ruled. But meanwhile, Darla rolls her eyes and is like, what a fucking loser.
And he got human blood for her.
Yeah. I mean, I guess for Darla, this is like a good person to know, because he can get her all the shit that she needs. But she does make a comment about how she would like it better if it was more fresh, like if she was able to drink someone rather than just have it come in a bottle.
Did you have the interpretation that when he went to the shower and she stood up, that she had been like downplaying her strength?
100%.
Yeah. Darla's nobody's baby.
No. Except for mine.
And so then we're at the karaoke bar and Angel is there to talk to Lauren, one of his other only remaining friends. There are some Wolfram and Hart lawyers shooting him some dirty looks, and Lauren calls him Angel Cakes.
He's got a broody stare and hot spiky hair. If you're straight or gay, your tingly feelings don't care. You're just being honest about this sexy demonic in your Bifurborianus.
And Angel is trying to get information about what's happening this Friday. And I was a little confused about like whose thoughts he was trying to get Lauren to give over to him. Yeah, Lauren is basically saying, I can't divulge to you what I read in another being.
Well,
but that's not true. He just did it. He did it with the guy who was like sad and wanted to capture his girlfriend in a sex moment.
Yeah. I mean, I think that was like a convenient storytelling device to make Angel in the story have to figure it out for himself and for us to figure out, you know, what it meant. But
okay, fine.
But I did appreciate that because we see Lauren as like a therapist, that he was kind of abiding by this like strict confidentiality clause. I thought that was pretty commendable.
Yeah, until he then tells him anyway. He's like, this coming Friday, so every 75 years, Wolfram and Hart has a review, and it's done by someone called the senior partner. Angel is like, oh, I think getting to this senior partner is my destiny. And Lauren kind of laughs at that and was like, I don't know about your destiny anymore. It seems a little murky to me.
Yeah.
So he's still kind of the one who is a little bit of a litmus test for Angel of like where he is on his path. And he's still off of it, you know, according to Lauren, at least. And Lauren says he does not know how the senior partner can be killed or if they can be killed.
He says something about a home office, which I found pretty relatable because it's just what we all have right now. But there was another thing that Lauren said, like as Angel was leaving, he was like, oh, one other thing. They all hate you.
And it was about the lawyers.
Yeah, but it's like, I think that Angel probably could have gotten that impression if he just like looked over.
Yeah, you know, that was a little bit of a, I can tell, my boobs can tell when it's already raining comment.
But Angel decides that to figure out this home office review situation, he has to do something.
And much like all of us, yeah, much like all of us, he realizes working alone at home isn't very fun.
Sure ain't. And apparently a book that he needs is missing. So unannounced, uninvited, he goes over to the new Angel Investigations office, busts right in, and tries to take the book. And Cordelia's like, no, you can't take this. I'm in the middle of it. Take this one instead. And if we're being honest, like, it's very possible that they are Angel's books. I mean, it's possible they could be Wesley's, but I just assumed that they were Angel's books.
And the way that Angel and Cordelia were fighting was like they were, it was like they were younger than even season one of Buffy. It was like they were in middle school. It was like, I don't know what you are anymore. I'm a vampire. Look it up.
Yeah, that was lame. But it is sad when he gets mean with her and he threatens violence, which he'd never done to her before, when he says, don't make me move you. And that's when Wesley's kind of just had it and is like, please just give him the fucking book so that he could leave. And then as he does leave, just as a little bit of foreshadowing, Cordelia says, if you were anyone else, I would just say, get laid already.
Oh, shit. I hadn't thought about it from the foreshadowing angle yet.
Oh, yeah.
We go to Kate's review, and she is being very seriously gaslit by a panel of her peers and bosses. They are focusing on the fact that she's been isolating herself and that she has a morbid fascination for cases of a macabre nature. And then what's really fucked up is they bring up her dad, basically to suggest that she lost it after he died and that she hasn't taken the proper time to heal, which is so incredibly patronizing.
Yeah. And they're also blaming it on her, like, not grieving correctly. Yeah. This whole scene is incredibly frustrating because of how, like, culty it is, and that there's no real way out unless you just do what, you know, if unless you just become a cog in the system.
And it's frustrating too, because then when she gets angry at them and is like, you have no idea what's going on in the city, they've painted her into this corner where if she tells the truth, it's just going to confirm the way they're painting her, because they don't believe her, and they, you know, it'll just like prove their point, basically.
Totally. It kind of reminded me of Claire Danes' character in Homeland, where all of her colleagues think that she's nuts, but really she's correct. And by like uncovering how deep so many of these corruptions go, like, she's in actual danger then too. So it's like, she's damned if she does, she's damned if she doesn't. And then one of the worst.
Did you do a recent Homeland rewatch?
Oh, I love Homeland. I rewatch season one pretty frequently because I think that that season is like absolutely one of the best seasons of television ever.
Did you watch the new season that came out like recently?
I haven't. I stopped after season three, or like around season three, I want to say. But I would get back into it.
Okay. Okay. I feel like it's one of those shows that in a post-Trump reality is harder to watch.
It was realistic fiction, but now it just feels like nonfiction almost.
Yeah. It's just like, oh, great. National trauma.
Yes. So then Kate is let go. And they say, one of the cops says, I'm glad your father isn't around to see this, which is one of the worst things I think you could possibly say. But I watch, did you watch the panel for Wizard World that had Claire Kramer, Amber Benson, James Marsters, and Elizabeth Rome? Did you end up?
I watched most of it. I watched most of it.
Did you watch the part where, I can't remember what the question was, but where she talked about the scene that she did in Sense and Sensitivity where she is being super honest with her dad. Did you hear her talk about that part?
I just know what you told me. So please share with us all.
Sure. So in this, you know, digital panel, she talked about how that scene in Sense and Sensitivity where she's like yelling at her dad was actually an incredibly cathartic experience because she has, or she had problems in real life with her dad. So she was able to like both get out her frustration and in a way like repair, you know, the wounds inside of her through this relationship with Trevor Lockley and Kate Lockley, which I thought was really interesting.
She has acted the role well.
Totally.
So, I mean, you know, it's good to know that there was some catharsis to come from that. Yeah, I feel like that the Trevor Lockley character, the actual version, not the long-haired equestrian version that we invented, but the actual version, I think, did effectively capture a very specific type of like dad archetype that I think, especially in the era it came out, probably resonated for many.
Totally.
But that's really interesting, especially given our, you know, daughter of a daddy running joke.
Yeah.
You know, I hope that if she ever listens to this podcast, it won't be seen as being flippant about something very real.
So basically, let's hope she never listens to this podcast.
Well, I don't know. I would love to still get her on as a guest. So we'll see.
I'll just go back and, you know, edit everything out.
At least one of us has been, you know, consistently pretty into Kate. Can't speak for both co-hosts of this show.
It's never about Elizabeth Rome. It's about the poor development of Kate.
Right. But remember when Michelle Williams was getting like death threats when she was Jenny on Dawson's Creek? That wasn't about her, but people still take it out on, you know, the actress, I think.
Okay.
Not that you were doing that. I'm not saying
I was sending death threats to Elizabeth Rome. So that's another reason why we can't get her on the podcast.
That is really fucked up, Brittany.
You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten. As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Then we get to revisit a character, and I don't know that we've seen this happen with a human character before. In Angel, we've certainly seen it happen with vampire characters, but I don't think we've ever seen before like the same character, but like later in their life, played by a different actor. So we see Denver again, your boy Denver.
Oh my God, love this guy.
Time has just made him sweeter than ever. And he, just to remind everyone, he was in the episode Are You Now or Have You Ever Been, which I believe was the second episode of season two of Angel. It was the episode where Angel was living in the hotel and ended up getting hung by the residents there. And in that episode, he ended up going to a bookstore and getting help from this, you know, like wiry alternative dude who I believe was your fuckwatch pick, or was he mine?
I think he was mine. I could be wrong.
I think he was too, but I double checked the doc that Brie and Lauren and Jess so kindly keep for us in our Patreon group on Facebook. And it was attributed to me, but I do not think that was the case. I think I remember you being very down for Denver.
Yeah, I could see that being the case.
He was just this really interesting foil for Angel in this moment, because he's someone who very much sees the good in Angel, because he has basically mythologized Angel in the last 50 years. Like he has this formative narrative about this person coming into his store and about him changing his life for the better, that now he feels like honored basically to get to help Angel again. And Angel in this moment, in this episode, is like balking at the picture Denver's painting of Angel, because he's like, no, I'm Angel now, I'm hard.
I thought it was a really cool moment to show that Angel, even though he feels like he's failing right now, he actually has such a history of helping so many people. And this is just like one example of someone whose life he radically helped change through just trying to save people. He's so deep in it and he's spiraling so hard that he can't even see or accept the fact that he has helped someone.
I mean, I agree with that. And also, I think he doesn't want to be seen right now necessarily as someone who's helped someone. We got a little peek of him maybe softening again in the last couple episodes, but this for me felt like he was really reestablishing himself as being kind of like in this purgatory version of Angel.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't good or bad, and he did not seem to want Denver to think of him as this like good guy.
Right, but then obviously when he is then killed,
no,
we can't necessarily say because of Angel, but it's certainly attributed to Angel. Like this guy potentially wouldn't have been killed had Angel not gone there. but that's just like another pile on thing for Angel to like get to the point that he needs to get at the end of this episode to kind of throw everything away. When all of a sudden we see that sword go through his sweet little body and then seeing Darla with a choker. Oh, man, that was
such a bummer. I mean, it was an incredible moment cinematically, yeah. But also really sad. I mean, as I've mentioned before, one thing that's happening during quarantine is my girlfriend and I are rewatching Buffy, her for the first time. And she made the astute observation that this death kind of had energetically the same feel as in early season 3 of Buffy when that really amazing guidance counselor gets killed, like right after he's been one of the only characters to really get through to Buffy in this deep way. And she's finally ready to like open up and accept help. And she's being really held and seen in this way. And then of course that guy has to die. And I kind of feel like they were doing a similar thing, like endearing the audience to someone who wants to see the best in Angel and maybe could have coaxed him closer to that place. And then being like, yep, if either of our heroes are going to have like a true ally, they need to die, is essentially what the lesson feels like.
Totally.
Or like a truly selfless ally. Because also what was happening right before Denver got killed by Darla is he was giving Angel the information that he needed. He was telling him, first of all, the senior partner has a ring and you will need a glove to this very particular glove that he happens to have that he's been using as an oven mitt in order to take on the senior partner. And another foreshadowing moment is he tells Angel it would be suicide to try and take down the senior partner.
So then Darla picks up the glove, kicks Angel in the face, and leaves, which she's able to because Angel is wounded from the sword as well. And it just got me thinking, like, who's going to run that sweet occult bookstore now? You know, I hope it doesn't go under. Then we see Wesley recovering from, you know, his bleeding stitches, and Virginia is there. And they have this conversation, which I think is kind of a perfect example of how sometimes in relationships, the thing that most attracted you to the other person is ultimately the thing that you resent about them, or it becomes the demise of why you can't work out. Like how Virginia.
That's a pretty bold theory you're just throwing out there. Is that your own or is that a thing?
I think that's a thing. Like, I think that so Virginia met Wesley when she thought that he was like this dangerous bodyguard and, you know, he was putting himself in the way of danger constantly and she was into that. And that's how she was attracted to him. But now she's kind of flipping it around and is like, your work is so dangerous. I don't know if I can handle that. And so the thing that most attracted her.
Oh, gotcha. So it's sort of like, so it's sort of like the reality of the thing that attracted her. So maybe like she still likes those qualities, but she not being romantically attached, she didn't have to see what goes into that.
Right. Like it's
and what's also sacrificed.
Yeah. It's like certain qualities or you know, certain things that you'll find attractive before you actually are like in a committed relationship with someone. You're like, oh my God, I love that they drink so, you know what I mean? I love that they go out all the time and they're so much fun. And then, you know, 6 months in, you're like, they're an alcoholic. Yeah, I can't do this.
But also this was sort of framed as a breakup scene ? Because she's saying that she wants Wesley to give up this life. And then he asks, could you be with someone who would give up, you know, something like this and something they were passionate about is what I took to be what he was saying without saying.
Yeah.
And then he said, are you breaking up with me? And she doesn't answer. But I was like, oh, my God, is Wesley's like intuition and emotional intelligence like more tapped in than mine is? Because that was not my takeaway from that conversation with Virginia. Like, I feel like if I were Wesley in that moment, I would have been like, okay, babe, I'll think about it.
Yeah. It definitely was very abrupt. And maybe just in my experiences, breakups are like long, arduous, like 6 to 9 months of back and forth of, I don't know. And, you know, just being kind of like secretly miserable for a while. But it felt like they were happy and pretty good before this happened. And it's just like this one event kind of made them see that they're just opposed in the way that they view what their relationship looks like or what Wesley's life looks like, which, yeah, I found to be pretty bold to just break up after that.
Yeah, I mean, no shade to the actress who plays Virginia. It's probably more so shade to the writers, but they were not really doing her any favors with giving her any sort of arc or any sort of development after, you know, once they kept her on as a series regular, they weren't really like doing anything with her other than just like
mentioning
being
her
a support system for Wesley.
Yeah.
So maybe that's what it was they needed. I mean, I guess it's yet to be seen if she's gone, but yeah, sad for Wes.
Yeah.
And also sad for Kate, who is hitting what appears to be room temperature vodka, which
God, is there anything
you know
worse?
You're in a dark place.
Yeah. And she looks at all of her trophies and I don't know about you, but I knew instantly she was going to push all those little babies to the floor, honey. And there's like a close-up photo of Trevor Lockley where he's not looking into camera. It looks like a candid photo where someone just like zoomed in really close on his face and she's looking at, you know, all the Little League pictures on the floor. And yeah, it's a dark, dark moment. And I imagine with trophies, it was meant to say like, I used to be something. I used to win at things. I used to be special. And now I have nothing.
Oh, poor Kate. Again, all you can hope is that she would, you know, this would bring about some sort of like needed shift and pivot in her life. But yeah, it's about to get darker before it gets brighter.
Yeah. And it's also, I mean, obviously her development, again, is only really through the context of like her as a cop and her as the daughter of a father. But like, we don't know anyone else that she has in her life. And so we assume that in some ways she's kind of like a mortal version of Angel right now, that all she's ever wanted to do is, you know, be this hero, because I think that's the way that she views what she was doing before she learned about all the corruption. And that, then when that gets taken away, like, what else do you have left if you've dedicated your whole life to that and you don't have any outside relationships? Like, I think that the parallels between she and Angel are pretty clear, and it just shows kind of like in Angel deciding to go down to the home office, it's basically like a death sentence in that regard. And so in some way, they're both kind of making the same decision in this episode. It just gets resolved in different ways. Outside the Wolferman Hart building, Lila has two bodyguards. So she is no longer parking in the parking garage. She's being dropped off by a limo and she has two bodyguards with her so that she can't have Angel show up out of nowhere again. But of course, he like launches out of the sky, knocks out her bodyguards. And she's like, what a waste of money.
I mean, come on, though, Lila, you should really know better at this point. Angel literally found out a way to sneak into your car without a key. Like,
yeah,
he's going to be able to take down your mere mortal bodyguards. Well, I guess I can't assume they're mortal. Excuse me. That was rude of me.
But he does this like funny evil thing where he's like, I want the same thing from you that I took from Lindsay. And he grabs her wrist. And she's terrified because she thinks that he's going to chop off her hand. But then he just uses it to get inside the building where there's a fingerprint scanner.
And there's a call coming into Cordy. And this little detail really got me, that like they hate Angel right now so much, or they're so pissed at him that they won't even say his name. Yeah. So when Cordelia answers the phone, she's like, hi there, this is Angelville Investigations. Can I help you? Yeah. And then Wesley, a beat later, refers to Los Angeles as the city of Angels. Yeah. I don't know, just a little joke that
just
really
for
hit,
you.
Really hit for me.
Yeah, it was really just for you. But Wesley calls to say that he is not coming in tomorrow because he doesn't feel well. And obviously Cordelia takes that as like, well, yeah, you like you have a huge injury and your stitches are bleeding. But I think, you know, what Wesley's obviously trying to say is that he's not feeling emotionally well because he and Virginia broke up. But I think that he, yeah, I don't know why he doesn't tell her in this moment. I assume that he's just trying to give off the impression that he, you know, is strong and doesn't need help. But he says something to the effect of, you should go out. It's Friday night. And Cordelia's like, where the fuck have you been? I haven't had a friend since I got impregnated by Ken Marino like 20 episodes ago. I'm not going out.
Then it becomes, I don't know, at least clear to me that part of the reason the mom of the girl with the eye in the back of her head was such a bitch at the beginning, or part of the reason that they made that choice from a writing perspective, is they wanted us to not care that she gets her damn throat snapped.
Oh, yeah, that was a snapperoo.
She calls Angel Investigations and is clearly trying to get Cordelia or someone from their team over to their house. And she definitely sounds nervous, like, you know, like someone's got a gun to her head or something. And she says that she'll give Cordelia a check if she stops by the house. And then as soon as she hangs up, she says, one of them is on their way here now. And then a really gnarly looking deem snaps her neck.
Yeah. So during a ritual at Wolfram and Hart, they find out that a vampire was let onto the floor, which is also funny because that's something that I think Angel was already counting on happening because of the fact that he knows Darla is there. And so someone shoots an arrow. Angel is still somehow like not spotted when he dodges it. He's just in a room full of people who are like looking down at their shoes. And then he throws holy water on this woman in a red dress with brown hair. But it turns out that, yes, it was Darla. She was wearing a wig and she has the glove. And then the dude with the ring comes out. And so both of these very necessary items are both in the same place that I think Darla was planning on just, you know, capitalizing on for herself. But then Angel has ruined it. One of the standout moments for me was when Lila, in reference to Darla, is like, shake the bitch.
And then Lindsay punches Lila.
Yeah.
A real line in the sand drawn right there when, you know, even though Lindsay and Lila are certainly no love lost there and they're basically competitors and would not be upset if one or the other was killed, like Darla is the one that nearly massacred both of them. And Lindsay's just such a little blind puppy dog in love with her that he will defend her at all costs.
Totally. I don't know if you notice or if this is just how they always are, but I like paid special attention to them. That so many of the punch sounds were the classic, like, whoosh, 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 whoosh. They just felt so like sound effects that were made by somebody's mouth.
Angel rushes the big bad demon with the glove and gets the ring off of him. He makes quick work of this. This sequence had so much action. Like, I had to watch it like 3 times to even understand all of the different beats of what was going on. And then crashes through a window and falls, and then an elevator opens behind Angel, and Holland is inside it.
Yeah.
Holland, as you'll remember, the former, you know, he was kind of presented as the boss of Wolfram and Hart, not as high up as the senior partner, but the biggest boss of the mortals. And he died in the wine cellar, but lo and behold, he's here in the elevator nonetheless. He's like, yeah, I am quite dead, but my contract with Wolfram and Hart extends long beyond my life, which, you know, I feel like there's so many kind of digs at lawyers in this show.
I think that if one thing's for sure about Wolfram and Hart, it's that they really need to look into getting heavier glass or just thicker glass, you know, because I think that there's been like 3 times now where a human being has just like broken through the glass.
Okay, I have a question.
Hit me.
About Angel's journey to hell. So they frame this basically that he needs to get to the senior partner's, quote, home office, which again, hello, mm-hmm. topical. And that means he needs to basically go to where this demon lives, which is hell, mm-hmm. and that he needs to take him down there. But Angel's been to hell.
Well, there's like, different dimensions of hell.
Okay, I guess that's what I needed clarity on, because he didn't call out like, you know, I've been there before. What's another time? And then, of course, this reveal that's coming up. I was just confused of, you know, why Angel would be so taken with this sort of metaphor that we're already in hell and that human beings and Earth and all of that, like, that already is terrible. And everyone, all the evil doing is already above the surface when he has experienced something much worse for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
Or what felt like hundreds of years.
Yeah. Well, I think like when you're in like the dimension of hell that he was in, I'm sure that it's like you can only really have hope in that way. I think that by the end of this conversation, he just has so little hope that like the line, the world isn't working in spite of evil. It works with us. It works because of us. Like, I think that's the line that ultimately shows Angel that of the dimensions that he's been in, there like truly is no hope. The world that he's in right now is set up so that people suffer and people are angry and sad and like evil can truly thrive in that environment. So I think that like, when the veil is removed from your eyes, that the world isn't great. Life is incredibly hard all the time. It kind of reminded me of a part in season 5 where this isn't technically a spoiler because it's just a line, but a part of season 5 in Buffy where a character says the hardest thing to do in this world is live in it, because it really is like to survive without being a part of like the evil machine feels impossible sometimes. Does any of that make sense?
Yeah, and I feel like that would make more sense to me for someone who's not already a vampire with a soul, who, if anything, is tortured on the daily with how terrible the world is because he is responsible for much of what is terrible in the world. Like, he has embodied it. You know, it's not like they were removing that veil for someone who is moderately sheltered or innocent. They were removing it for someone who kind of already believes that. But I guess maybe that they were just trying to show like this is what tipped him over the edge. Like,
yeah,
he maybe was still holding on to the idea that there is good, or the idea that maybe just there is something worse.
Yeah. Or like it could also be that it killed any hope that he can make a difference. You know, like when Holland is saying, like when Holland is trying to be like, oh, it must be difficult to do what you do because there's no, like, the way that they see it at Wolfram and Hart is like, it's not about winning. Like, they've already won in a way. And so Angel is just constantly having to swim against like a huge current. And so in that regard, it's almost like, you know, it's kind of coming back to his scene with Denver where like he feels like he maybe isn't making a difference, but like there are ways that he does make a difference and he does help people. But it's just like overshadowed by just how much more work is left to be done that he can't possibly do on his own. So it's like, what's the point at all? Is I think like potentially how he feels.
Yeah.
Especially as he's walking that dark night alone. He's maybe a little cold watching people just be awful to each other.
Yeah. Just seeing evil in every single person. And Holland had made some comment of, you know, if they weren't evil, they wouldn't be people. They'd all be angels. Mm-hmm. So it was sort of like presenting this perspective we haven't, I think, heard before so explicitly, that Angel, like, there's something about the type of soul or the type of cumulative experience that Angel has that almost makes him better than people.
Yeah, it like makes him saintly, and that there's nobody else really out there with his same, you know, like moral compass. But then we cut to Kate at her house. And by now, she's pretty intoxicated and she grabs a pill bottle. So this is where, you know, we can pretty much assume that this is like there's this little like montage of Wesley heartbroken at his house, Cordelia headed towards Mrs. Sharp's house. Angel gets back to the hotel and Kate has left this, you know, incoherent voicemail that's blaming Angel for all this and saying, like, you made me believe. And, you know, she's, when we see at her house, she's rolling around with the vodka and with the pills. And this is the lowest we've ever seen her, for sure.
And we are meant to understand that Angel did hear this voice message, right?
Yeah. I mean, he listens to it, but then he ignores it. So, like, you know, this is him making a choice that, you know, it's clear that someone needs his help, but he is ignoring that call.
And someone who I would argue more than the average person, he kind of has a direct role and direct culpability in her decline with her mental health. You know, not that he's, I understand that, like, from through like her arc, it was never that he was intentionally fucking her over, but definitely Angel arriving into Kate's life was a net negative.
Yeah, it's like an indirect responsibility, but a responsibility regardless.
Yeah, and it's someone who is his friend or as close to a friend as he really has right now. And so he is sort of fully and consciously turning away, which is really kind of horrific to witness. Mm-hmm. And what he's turning toward is Darla.
Yeah, so this is like his descent into the darkness. Like, this is in this series, you know, these are the darkest choices that he's made, or like the choices that are most quote unquote off his path. And yeah, when he gets into his room, he can feel Darla there. And, you know, he has the ring. He drops it on the ground and he's like, you can have it. But just as we think he's going to be kind of apathetic, he then becomes super active, being really violent with Darla, grabbing her by the wrist, throwing her against a wall. And then it turns into, you know, a sexual thing that even Darla, you know, the soulless vampire, is like, what the fuck got into you? Like, is everything okay? That even someone else with a soul is like, hang on, do you want to talk about this?
There have been multiple allusions in the past to when they were both vampires, they had a lot of rough sex. And it was sort of like the kind that she preferred. Mm-hmm. And even she is like, I don't know, should we talk about a safe word or yeah. What's going on right now? You're doing this with a soul? Okay.
I will say that the line of his that said, I just want to feel something besides the cold, sounded like a line that Spike would say.
Definitely. The poet. Mm-hmm. And it also reminded me of the first scene that we see Darla in this episode where she complains that the blood is cold.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just I don't know if that was intentional, but just like these tiny little echoes that this episode has.
You know how with Darla, she's a very complex character, because even when we know she doesn't have a soul, there's like glimmers of her soul in there. And when she says, don't play games with me, it feels like it's because of an emotional reason. Like, she doesn't want to get hurt by him. And I thought that...
Yeah, that's still the human Darla peeking through.
Yeah, and I found that really kind of, like, sweet in a weird way. That even though, you know, one could argue that this is what she's been wanting and he is giving it to her, she's unsure of his intentions, and so she's trying to make sure that, like, it's for real before she invests herself in it, which, yeah, is like a very human thing. So that, you know, further complicates the villain that is Darla, because there's parts of her that totally aren't a villain.
Yeah, but it's like the creators just didn't want to give us any chance of really enjoying this moment without hating ourselves, because we know that, you know, Angel is doing this while he knows that Kate is attempting to kill herself.
Right. Yes. I imagine that we all remember Surprise from Buffy season 2. So you might be thinking to yourself, oh no, should Angel be having sex? Because as we know, he's cursed. When he feels one moment of true happiness, he will lose his soul once more and fully become Angelus. So he will fully be, you know, his worst villain self. But Angel is clearly, you know, making the worst decision he can possibly make, the most careless decision, which kind of reminds me of Too Hot to Handle, the new Netflix series, yeah, where contestants know that the worst thing they could do for the group dynamic is to have sex because they will lose money for the other pot of contestants, but they do it anyways.
And they even, this episode even ended with a beat that was reminiscent of the very end of Surprise, where Darla's still asleep, Angel wakes up in bed next to the woman he's just slept with and seems to like have some sort of pain in,
yeah,
his head.
Well, it's like it thunders, it's lightning, you know, he like gasps for air, and as the audience we're like, oh no, he lost his soul.
Or maybe he gained back an extra one if you know, the equal and opposite force of Darla, who knows.
But the way that him losing his soul is defined as if he experiences a moment of pure happiness. So, you know, what happens?
I don't know if I would define this as happiness. Well, we'll see.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's going to be the test, is if he loses his soul, then he was happy. But if he doesn't lose his soul, then Darla could probably take that pretty personally, that sex with her was not happiness compared to sex with Buffy.
Ooh, speaking of sex and happiness.
Letting understand and consent. Letting understand and consent and consent. Letting understand and consent and consent. Fat watch. All right, so I don't know if I already chose this person.
I can tell you, I have it pulled up.
Okay, well, did I choose Darla yet?
I'm pretty sure you did.
I think I've been saving it.
I feel like you chose it, because remember I chose it when she, and then someone pointed out that she had chlamydia.
She had a syphilic heart condition, you monster.
Oh, sorry. You, I thought chose her the next episode.
Yeah, but that's very possible.
Let me just check our records brought to us by our sweet patrons. So it does appear that you chose Darla in redefinition.
Damn it. Okay. I need a moment. You go ahead.
So I am going to choose Denver this time. I feel like when you chose him, when you chose the young Denver back in Are You Now or Have You Ever Been, I got it, but I didn't really get it. You know what I mean? And I feel like there was something about like age and maturity and wisdom that really worked well for Denver. And I think this was such a chaotic episode in so many ways, like the most obvious being Angel's dark bent and how the kind of morality that we expect from him is not there and is kind of crumbling. But then also, you know, all of these characters are just, there's so many assholes in this episode. There's like Lindsay punching Lila. There's Cordelia and Wesley and Gunn fighting with Angel. There's the woman not wanting to pay for the hard work that Angel Investigations did. Like everyone's kind of terrible, which I think fits with the resolution of this episode, or the escalation of it rather. And I feel like Denver is this like sole bit of light in this particular episode. And he just made me feel like really comforted. I would love to like be in his bookstore. I would love to have him read to me. and I really grieved him. So I think I'm going to choose Elder Denver this episode.
Nice. So just going off the cuff here, because I already chose the person that I wanted to choose. I'm going to go for something that's a little vintage. Something that is a little more manual than automatic, if you know what I mean. And I'm going to choose that glove. That glove that Denver got in 1975 at a yard sale in Covina. I think that, you know, self-pleasure is obviously a form of a fucking. And so that's what I'm going to choose. And because I'm quarantined, I don't want to risk, if I'm a carrier, I don't want to pass it to someone else. So I think it's also the most responsible choice if I stay quarantined with an inanimate object.
And as we've heard, it can be used as an oven mitt. And one thing I've been doing more than maybe any other time in my life
is
right now
is using your
cooking.
Vibrators as oven mitts.
No, Brittany. Flirting, understanding, consent, and kissing. Flirting, understanding, consent, and kissing.
Fuckwatch.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Angel on Top. I'm Laura Zach. You can find me at Laura Zach on Instagram, at @law_wa on Twitter.
And I'm Brittany Ashley. And you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Brit27Ash.
You can also follow Angel on Top on Instagram and Twitter at AngelOnTopCast. And you can email us at all one word, angelontoppodcast@gmail.com.
And now, please enjoy the poem Reprise from Angle's perspective. Reprise. Another solo mission. Mood still morose. Even I'm surprised to find a room full of goats. At least I foiled that plan for the Wolfram and Heartless. I'll admit smashing those vases gave me a little catharsis. I'll pay a visit to my only ally. We can't always have our druthers. But seems the blue only accept brutality when they're doing onto others. These cops always lose their minds when you leave the scene of a crime. Kate says there's blood on her hands, or is it just some red wine? Not even the singing demon can tell me some good news. All he can say, senior partners are planning a performance review. Unwelcome reunion with ex-family leads me to bookstore from my past. I learned this ring allows interdimensional travel. I can put an end to chaotic evil at last. I retrieve the glove, well, sort of, before bookworm becomes a kebab. Wielding the sword as my ex, my maker. I'm the ensouled bottom to her power top. I get past security with Lila's prince just in time to stop the firm's ritual. Maybe it's just me, but launching through their windows is starting to feel habitual. With glove and ring, it's time for a ride down the elevator to the home office. Greeted by Holland, well, his ghost at least, it's time to meet his hellbent bosses. Holland lectures me as we fall from gravity. Turns out hell is actually just reality. Dazed, confused, more hopeless than ever, I head to my bedroom, but I'm not alone. If Darla wants the ring, sure, have at it. Because what I really want is to bone. It's been cold in this body. I need some heat. I throw my ex-lover down on the sheets. Over 2 centuries, but finally we reprise. In the middle of the night, I sense a surprise.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for 2 women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz. And how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.